And now for our discourse this morning, we have our brother Chris Napchinski to serve us, and he has chosen for his topic, one that's slightly unusual, looking back at the future and other lessons with the prophet Isaiah. Looking back at the future and other lessons with the prophet Isaiah. Brother Chris.
Good morning, brethren. And I don't know how it is that some numbers have shifted, but the hymn we were going to open with was Holy, 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 which is 223A. And I don't know how it is that 335 and 223 are similar, but they are not. But the hymn that we did sing is a wonderful hymn as well. I remember one brother who was visiting us from the United States oftentimes back in my youth in Poland. And this was his favorite hymn. It was, his name was Brother Grudzkiewicz. And I actually appreciate that hymn very much. When I learned English, I realized that the words in the Polish translation are very, very faithful to almost every line here in this hymn. And that was his motto, to be faithful to the Lord, and whether it had to be through some experiences. And it is through the experiences that we grow. And so we appreciate those sentiments and appreciate that we opened with this hymn. Our topic is looking back at the future and other lessons with Prophet Isaiah. And I was tempted to name this topic Back to the Future, but I realized that it wasn't exactly working this way. But in some way, we want to talk about the time aspect of the prophecy of Isaiah. What you see here on the screen is the writing of the name Isaiah in the Hebrew language. And as you see, you probably will ask yourself, well, what are those scribbles at the very top? Those are actually the Paleo-Hebrew letters, which are probably more likely to be what the original scripts were written by. Then the second script here that you see over here. Let's see if this will work. This would be the more updated script. This would be the script that you will find in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And that's, I think it's called a more of an Aramaic script, which actually resembles the more modern script of the current Hebrew, which is right here. And it's not advancing very well here, but the bottom one where you see those Hebrew letters that you're more familiar with. That name in Hebrew is Yeshayahu, with kind of a soft ha, so not the hard palate ha. And it means salvation from the Lord, from Jehovah. But why do we want to talk about it? Why are we looking at this topic today? Well, the reason is that the speaker is kind of prepared for this, because I've taken a little time to prepare for one lesson for this year's Midwest Bible Students Youth Camp. And so their theme was Isaiah. And while we are trying to restart the presentation, because something has broken about it, I'll just tell you that Brother Brett has asked a number of brethren to prepare a lesson or two about Isaiah. There was an outline that was given to us, so it's always very helpful when you know what the subject is going to be. And so his the subject that he assigned to me was the desolation, captivity, and return. And so you will see that the brethren have prepared a very nice setup of lessons for the young people, and also even t-shirts. And the topic or the title of the camp was Isaiah, Prophet of Salvation. And so I know that a few others from Chicago have prepared for prepared the outlines for the young people. And I know, or I'm thinking maybe they will also want to share something about Isaiah in the upcoming time. So this will be a little bit of my own, discovery and some of the research that has happened And I know each of us cherishes the book of Isaiah greatly. We all find it inspiring and both prophetic and informative. And we are going to try and just skip through a few details. It won't be by any means comprehensive. But this is more or less the outline of what we want to cover. Look at the impact, truths, and resources that are available for your study of Isaiah. Take up a question whether the book of Isaiah could possibly be a so-called microcosm of the Bible, and we'll see why. Also discuss the question of authorship, some challenges that are around the book of Isaiah's authorship by Isaiah, and how we can deal with this question. Find out perhaps a little more about how you can go back and look at the future with Isaiah, and look at some warnings against arrogance and idolatry and other sins that were so gravely pronounced in Isaiah. And then, if time permits, we'll try to see if there is a way to understand how Isaiah can be thought to be a very exquisite poet. And that's the opinion that the scholars have about his writings. So we will see if we can catch that. When did Isaiah live? Well, as we see on this slide, during the period of kings. And the first verse of Isaiah says that very clearly. The vision of Isaiah, the son of Amoz, concerning Judah and Jerusalem, which he saw during the reigns of Jotham, Ahaz, and Hezekiah, kings of Judah. So we see that Isaiah's prophecies were more toward and about Judah and Jerusalem. We know that as far as this chronological line, Judah was at that time separate from the other northern kingdom. And if we were to put in a couple of charts here, a couple of bubbles here on the timings, we see that the kingdom was divided right after Solomon's death, right here at the top, and then Israel's first Assyrian captivity, that's the northern kingdom, started right at the end of the reign of Uzziah, which is that first king highlighted here in yellow. Then we remember that event on Sennacherib's, who was an Assyrian king, defeat in Hezekiah's reign. That would be still also in the days of Isaiah, because Isaiah plays a role there. And then finally, around the year 606, Judah's captivity happens to Babylon. So what would seem to be the case is that Isaiah lived, having lived in the years of these four kings, probably died somewhere around the year 717 BC. Possibly there is a tradition, Jewish tradition, that Manasseh, the son of Hezekiah, the son of the good King Hezekiah, actually caused the death of Isaiah. And when we read in Hebrews that some were sawn asunder, the tradition is that that's the death that Isaiah suffered at the hand of the king Manasseh. Whether it's true or not, we will find out in the future when we know better what really happened. There is no confirmed script that we would see about that. But let's think about the resources that are available to us for the study of the book of Isaiah. If you look at some tools, for example, one wonderful tool called Truth Search Tool, which Brother Grabner just recently re-released, you will find about 1,000 mentions of either the word Isaiah or a citation from Isaiah in Pastor Russell's writings, which we hold very dear and really should look at those references very closely. One article that I appreciated reading that gave a good overview of it was reprint 2370, The Prophet's Isaiah Vision. Now, if you open your Christian Resources app, you will find that there are about 48 results in that application, and a couple of discourses that I really enjoyed listening to. Others were, I'm sure, enjoyable, but probably more focused. There was a recent discourse from Brother Wes Kramer, Isaiah, and Brother Jerry Leslie's recent discourse that we heard in Chicago, Greater Than Cyrus, where the prophecy about Cyrus including the name of Cyrus that was prophesied about 150 years before his birth, was mentioned in the book of Isaiah, chapters 44 and 45. But you will find a lot of other materials online. There are sites upon sites. There's one very good site called Isaiah Institute. And a Jewish scholar, Avraham Gileadi, has his own translation of the book of Isaiah and really goes into a lot of detail of all the chapters. And this is all very good for us because we have to really understand a little more about the times and the nature of his various utterances and the situation, the historical background. So while some of these don't have the same view of the what the spiritual meaning of the prophecy of Isaiah lead us to, there is definitely good information there to really get involved. Now, we also had a few discourses by our brethren here from Chicago. One that's stuck with me is the one by Brother Joe, "The Stability of Your Times," which is a quote from Isaiah, or "A God Who Hides Himself," Brother Tom Rigirello, and Brother Paul Balco, who is here with us some time ago, gave us a discourse on "Us and Isaiah," a very intriguing title where we appreciated Brother Paul's reflections on that prophecy and how it applies to our life. So when we look at all this material, we are inspired by awe and appreciation for the power of God in the revelation that he has given to Isaiah. Topics on both literal and current events to him, and those that are the spiritual fulfillment of his prophecies. If we were to take a look at the book of Isaiah and do the so-called word cloud, which tells you what are the words that are so often mentioned. The bigger they are, the more often they are mentioned in the Bible, in this book. And you can see how the focus of Isaiah was on the Lord, on the nation, or the people of Israel, and how earth and land was also a focus. It's a little hard to really give a very good concise summary of what the book of Isaiah, you know, was about, you looking at the slide like this, but let this be also a way of us to try and get to associate what the content of Isaiah is about. Here are a few cherished truths that we find in Isaiah. We see that Israel and Judah was warned about gradual punishments and about upcoming desolation that was going to be there for their sins and for their lack of faithfulness to the Lord. We'll have a slide or two about that later. But the exile and return from Babylon was prophesied in the later chapters, but also even as early as in chapter 13. The prophetic double, remember that one? Comfort ye, my people. And there is a mention that her punishment is accomplished because she has received double. And so that's where we have our lessons about double. That's chapter 40 in Isaiah. Of course, we have the prophecies of the birth, the mission, the sufferings, and exaltation of the Messiah. And that's the wonderful chapters of 7, 11, 52, 53, and 61. And we won't have the time to quote it, but those are the gems that we cherish and that we interpret to be very much the future fulfillment of what Jesus was going to be and to do, and what his mission was going to be. The messianic kingdom, the solitary place that rejoices, the great fulfillment where no one will hurt or destroy on God's holy mountain. The sacrifice of Christ and the church, chapter 53, who has believed our report. The feet members, how great it is to hear the news of those who are on the mountains, the feet of him who gives good message that your God reigns. That's Isaiah 52:7, paraphrasing. thoughts about the world peace, the inauguration of the law covenant, restitution, the pride, arrogancy, and punishment of Satan, the division between the kingdom, spiritual and earthly, about new heavens and new earth, which then the Apostle Peter says, we expect them according to the promise. And the fact that the earth remains forever, that God has created this earth for the habitation, for it to be inhabited, which is the hope that we have and extract from the scriptures, not in this only place, but in others, unlike some prevailing views and Christian beliefs that have us see the earth destroyed and that the new earth really means a completely new recreated earth. We believe and understand that God in his wise economy, what he means by this is he will re-establish a new order of things, both in the earthly sense and spiritual sense, and that this will be the fulfillment of the expression, the new heavens and the new earth. So, as we continue, let's now review a quick way to kind of try and understand what is the content of the book of Isaiah from the very structure of the book. And I'm going to play a short animation from a really wonderful project called the Bible Project. It's one of these new, efforts that you definitely can find out there. I'm sure you have seen when you watch some videos on the internet how an animation that kind of develops with words and with pictures can really make a lasting, impression on you and help you learn. So this is one of those, and it's, again, from the Bible Project, trying to summarize the structure of the book of Isaiah. So let's take a listen.
Isaiah lived in Jerusalem in the latter half of Israel's kingdom period, and he spoke on God's behalf to the leaders of Jerusalem and Judah. He spoke, first of all, a message of God's judgment. He warned Israel's corrupt leaders that their rebellion against their covenant with God would come at a cost, that God was going to use the great empires of Assyria and after them Babylon to judge Jerusalem if they persisted in idolatry and oppression of the poor. But that announcement was combined with a message of hope. Isaiah believed deeply that God would one day fulfill all of his covenant promises, that he would send a king from David's line to establish God's kingdom, remember 2 Samuel 7, that he would lead Israel in obedience to all of the laws of the covenant made at Mount Sinai, remember Exodus chapter 19. And all of this was so that God's blessing and salvation would flow outward to all of the nations, like God promised to Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. And it's this hope that compelled Isaiah to speak out against the corruption and idolatry of Israel in his day. Now, the book has a pretty complex literary design, but there's one simple way to see how it all fits together. Chapters 1 through 39 contain three large sections that develop Isaiah's warning of judgment on Israel. And it all culminates in an event pointed to at the end of chapter 39, the fall of Jerusalem and the exile of the people to Babylon. But in chapters 1 to 39, there's also a message of hope that after the exile, God's covenant promises would all be fulfilled. And chapters 40 to 66 pick up that promise of hope and develops it further.
Okay, so we have a very interesting outline of the book of Isaiah here in this kind of animated format. We see how, on the one hand, Isaiah is pronouncing judgments and warnings for the kings of Judah and telling them to lead the nations in faithfulness to God. And yet he is also extending the message of hope and comfort. And that's how the book is actually divided. The very interesting division, you will find that the chapters that have to do more with the judgment and pronouncement of warning and desolation end with the chapter 39, and that chapters 40 through 46 are called the book of comfort or the book of hope. And you know, the very first words of chapter 40 is exactly that, comfort ye, comfort ye, my people. And so that's why that's the beginning of that second section, the Book of Comfort. And we'll talk about that a little more because there is actually some important debate that's going on about that. So how do we know who wrote this book and what really is the content of it? How do we know that these words there are not just put together through some other means by other people at different times. How far back can we prove the book of Isaiah was being used and read by others? Well, up to the 1940s or 50s, our sources were going into our Christian era. I think a few hundreds of the Christian era that the manuscripts were available. But in the 1940s, a big discovery was made. I'm sure you've heard about the Dead Sea Scrolls, which were scrolls found in the in the caves of Qumran in Israel by some Bedouins. And among them was a very complete scroll with the book of Isaiah, dated back to 150 to 250 BC. So still the time before Christ. And so that inspires us with just wonderful, wonderful confirmation of our faith. And yes, the manuscripts that were known to us, that had been known to us before the Dead Sea Scrolls were found, turned out to be very faithful and very complete as well. So that tells us about how well the Jewish nation protected and preserved the words of the Old Testament, and we know that God was also behind that. But what we know about the scroll, the great Isaiah scroll from the Dead Sea Scrolls, is that it contains the entire book of Isaiah in Hebrew, and just has a few small damaged parts. What you see here is really the 54 pages, and the total length of that scroll is about 24 feet. So you can imagine quite a long span. Very interesting, the height of it is 11 inches. So our 8.5 by 11 in height is probably a well-founded standard. But what we do see is in a very, very exact detail, all the words of Isaiah. Of course, they were not, this is not the script that was written by Isaiah, because he lived somewhere in that era, that year 717 all the way to early 800s BC. So by this time, this manuscript is about 500 or 600 years old, but still, a great testimony of what was cherished, what had been cherished by that nation for many hundreds of years. Now, let me just show you, if I can, that there is a website called dsscollectionsimj.org.il that actually is enabling us to see this in great, great detail, where we are actually able to zoom in on the scroll of Isaiah, and we can see verse by verse where each of these verses, chapter 2, verse 17, for example, and then, it comes up with the actual, verse. Now, the script here is, going back to our first slide, is that second, not the very, very scribbly Paleo-Hebrew, but this is the Aramaic Hebrew. So the Aramaic Hebrew started when the Jews resided in Babylon. When they returned, they were using that type of script. So this is just a wonderful testimony. You can scroll through this script and see exactly what you're interested in. And we actually will do this in a little bit, because we want to know about the chapter 40. What does it look like? Where is it written? So let's go back to our slides. And definitely quite a rich resource that we have without having to move, step out of our home. So we said something interesting about these chapters, and I think you know where I'm going with this. I'm sure many of you have heard it, that perhaps there's something interesting about the book of Isaiah having 66 chapters, the first significant part ending at book 39, and books 40 through 66 being this book of comfort. What does it sound like? It sounds like the Bible, the Old and New Testament. And there is actually quite an interesting theory that if we take the chapters of Isaiah and put them across so that the first book perhaps has some significance, correlation to the book of Genesis, and book 66 maybe has something connected to the book of Revelation, that you can find that connection. And so let's give it a try. We're just going to do a few samples and see if we would agree. There's a gentleman by the name Dustin Blythe who wrote a whole book about that. and I think it'd be a good, interesting research. I don't know if we should necessarily agree with it, but let's take a look at this. So the first chapter, as you see, it will be on the right side, because that's how we start reading in Hebrew, from the right to left. The first chapter takes us to the book of Genesis, and let's see what verse there is. So in Isaiah chapter 1, verse 2, the verse says, "Listen, O heavens, and hear, O earth, for the Lord speaks." And what do we find in the book of Genesis? In the beginning, God has created the heavens and the earth. Quite interesting. Now let's jump to chapter 40, which is the first beginning of that section of the book of comfort. Verse 3, which we know from reading this, also from Handel's Messiah, a voice is calling, "Clear the way of the Lord in the wilderness, make smooth in the desert a highway for our God." And in Matthew, which is the 40th book of the Bible, here is a reference directly to that chapter. Somehow it just happened that it's the 40th book in the Bible, but John, it's about John the Baptist. "For this is the one referred by Isaiah the prophet, saying, 'The voice of one crying in the wilderness, make ready the way of the Lord, make his paths straight.'" So let's jump on to a couple more. Chapter 43. So Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John. Chapter 43, that's the book of John. Chapter 43, verse 8 in Isaiah, "Bring forward the people who are blind but have eyes." Also he says, "And deaf who have ears." And one of the significant scriptures in John chapter 9, Jesus says, "For judgment I came into this world, that those who do not see may see, and those who see may become blind." And it has been the statement that Jesus made a number of times about the Jewish nation at that time, that they had eyes but could not see. Just like the mission that Isaiah was on when he was going to disclose the truth, remind the nation of Israel and Judah about their condition, and yet they would not hear, they would not see that. A couple more. Chapter 46 points us to the book of 1 Corinthians 46 in Isaiah. "For I am God, there is no other. I am God, and there is no one like me." And in 1 Corinthians 8:6, we read, "Yet for us there is but one God, the Father, for whom are all things, and we exist in him, and one Lord, Jesus Christ, by whom are all things, and we exist through him." Okay, now we are going to chapter 53, and quite interestingly, we find that chapter 53 corresponds to, well, I don't know if it corresponds to something specific, but if you take the 27 last books of the Bible, divide them by half, you end up with this chapter 53, which is nothing else but the most famous, most clear prophecy, it seems, pointing to Jesus and the reason for the New Testament and the books of the New Testament. Of course, he was also the reason for the Old Testament writings, because he was the Lamb that was slain before the foundation of the world. So where do we go with this? Well, we think that there might be something to it. We have to remember, though, that the chapters and verses were not put into the biblical script until the 12th or 13th century. So in the year 1227, Langton was a professor at the University of Paris, and he divided the Bible into chapters. And the verses were added even later, and that was like in 1551. Why were they added? I think convenience. We now can very quickly cross-reference, refer, find on the computer by now all the different references in the scriptures. But just like with other things, could God's presence and understanding of what's going to happen in the time in the future have had anything to do with how he laid out the prophecy that he gave to Isaiah, so that we can now be reaffirmed at these different points? Well, it's for us to decide. However, we're going to try and look at this structure of the book of Isaiah again and ask this question So he wrote the chapters from 1 to 39, and chapter 39, if you recall, ends with Hezekiah's recovery from his sickness. And the king Hezekiah invited Babylonians, who were then a fledgling nation, not yet as strong as they would be, you know, 100-some years later. And he invited them. He just had overcome the Assyrians. He just, the 180,000 Assyrian people had just died at the doors of Jerusalem because of Hezekiah's faith and trust in the words of Isaiah. So now Hezekiah had just been told that he's going to die. He recovers miraculously also and is given the 15 more years of his life. You remember that clock that went back by 10 degrees, which was a sign that Hezekiah's days would be extended. So Hezekiah is really on top of the world, and Babylonians, who are not yet, powerful, they visit him and they say, and he actually shows them everything in their in his house, everything in the temple. In fact, Isaiah asks him, "What did you show them?" And he says, "I showed them everything. There was really nothing that I have not shown them." I guess I would imagine he was just so pleasantly encouraged by all the things that happened in his life. And then it is that in chapter 39. The prophet Isaiah says, "Everything that you have shown them will be taken away to Babylon, and that everything and the people will also be taken away." So that's the promise of the exile. We know that this did happen. We know that the chapters 40 through 66 start with the words of comfort, talk about God's servant. We know that chapter 53 talks about God's servant who will have to suffer, and all the hopeful and wonderful things are said in the chapters 40 through 66. But now the question is, when were these words written? There is a big challenge to Isaiah's authorship of these chapters. Basically, the opinion is that these were written by some other folks who lived back in the day of the Babylonian captivity, and that these writings were simply appended or attached. So I wanted to play to you two clips from two Bible scholars, and perhaps to give a little better understanding of this conflict or the challenge to authorship, and also how we as students of the Bible should look at it. So let's try and do that. The first one is Christine Hayes. She is a professor at Yale University. On YouTube, you will find very informative lectures on the introduction to Old Testament. This clip will try to just briefly say how this topic of the authorship of Isaiah is introduced.
Second Isaiah. So there are two discrete units of material that are appended to Isaiah. Chapters 40 to 55 are referred to as Second Isaiah, and chapters 56 to 66 are referred to as Third Isaiah. And these chapters differ from Isaiah proper, the 8th century prophet, in several ways. It's clear, first of all, that these parts of Isaiah were written after the exile, to a large parts of Isaiah, Third Isaiah, written after the exile, all of Second Isaiah. And Isaiah proper was clearly written in the 8th century on into the early 7th century. Jerusalem is referred to as destroyed. The audience that's addressed is living in exile. Babylon is the oppressor, not Assyria. Assyria was the oppressor in the time of Isaiah proper. So the appended materials even seem to know of the overthrow of the Babylonians. That's going to happen in about 539 when Cyrus of Persia will destroy, will conquer the Babylonians. We have passages that express some euphoria over this because Cyrus, of course, authorized the Jews to return from Babylon to Jerusalem to rebuild their temple. There are also all kinds of stylistic differences.
Okay, so I think we get the gist of what she's saying. She's basically saying that these later books were obviously written by somebody else because the faithfulness to the detail is so amazing, is so true, that the exaltation of the release from the Babylonian captivity, that the name and mention of Cyrus are mentioned there. This is just impossible that it could be a prophecy written back then, or there would be words written by back then by Isaiah. And as we, before we introduce the second view here, which actually tries to argue with this very successfully, I think, in Isaiah chapter 41, verses 21 through 24, we read that the Lord is challenging people who believe in idols. He says, present your case, produce your arguments, bring out those idols, and have them foretell the future for us. Tell us about past events, too, so that we can reflect on them and understand their consequences. Or tell us about events yet to come. State what will happen in the future, so that we will know that you are gods. And as we look at the second clip here, I'll just mention that Steve Gregg, he's a Bible teacher, has this ministry called Narrow Path, I think. And I did listen to a few of his lectures on Isaiah. I have to say that I give him credit for the fairness that he really does put in his lectures. He, I appreciate him for his honesty and kind of faith-based approach. And by his own choice, he is kind of on the margin of this mainstream due to his non-standard approach and independent thinking. He says that he's teaching how to think about the Bible, but and not what to think. So I find this quite interesting and respectable.
The gods, the pagan gods, were made of stone and wood. They couldn't tell the past or the future. They couldn't tell what's going on right in front of them because they were mindless. But the point is that being able to tell the past wouldn't prove that you're a god, but it would at least prove that you got breath in you, and the idols didn't. But God seems to imply that if you can tell the future accurately, you've shown that you've got credentials as God. Now, that's exactly the thing that God used to credential those who were genuine prophets. He is God. He does know the future. He can tell what will happen, and he can tell his prophets, and they can tell others. And it was this ability to tell the future that is God's own stamp of divine origin for the writings of the book of Isaiah. And yet it's that very feature that has caused skeptics who don't believe in the supernatural to say, Isaiah couldn't have possibly written those chapters because they contain accurate predictive prophecy. And this mood against Isaiah arose in the late 19th century, especially in German seminaries, places like Tübingen, which has produced a vast number of liberal scholars and authors, and the mood shifted out or spread out until it permeated most of biblical scholarship, including many people who are call themselves evangelicals or conservatives.
So he gives us a little bit of a background why this started happening. The lack of trust in the predictive aspect of prophecy, that God is able to tell you what's going to be in the future. Well, there are some arguments that you can bring and dispute the fact that, for example, Isaiah's name is not mentioned in the 40 to 66 chapter, but he's not writing about his time. That time that he's writing about is future. His words are considered to be prime poetry, and yet, how would it be that the Jewish nation would be able to say whose words they are, because if it were to be accepted that it's simply an unknown, anonymous, or not named author. And importantly to us, the New Testament refers to Isaiah by name 22 times, mentioning, quoting, and citing, and many more times, about 40 times, is the Isaiah prophecy quoted without mentioning his name. Here are some fragments, John 12:38-40, and John the Baptist says, I am the voice of that was mentioned by Isaiah. And that voice is already in that later part of the script. And then Jesus mentions both the early and reads a late from a late chapter That's in Matthew 13 and Luke 4, 17. In fact, we'll probably have a moment to look at that. And of course, we have the multiple references of the Apostle Paul. Now, the one thing that was very pointed for me was the way in which those Dead Sea Scrolls place this chapter 40 in the setup, in the alignment. So let's just take a look at this on the screen. What you will find here is that this sheet that has this number 40 there, that's something that I placed there, that this chapter 40 does not start in like a new column, is not part of a different scroll. It's all considered to be one book. And just to even be more assured about that, you see how the words of chapter 40 don't even start at the top of the new page. They're actually the very last line after what we would number now as chapter 49. And just for comparison purposes, here you see those Aramaic words that are so clearly now parallel to the modern Hebrew, comfort ye, comfort ye, my people. So we are very encouraged by that. We think that this understanding that Isaiah's authorship was not there associated with these later chapters is just a sign of the lack of faith, and that's really what it is. We were recently at the Harvest Convention, and we looked at God's patience, the question of that for those of you who remember those talks and who were able to be there. The thought was that God has taken basically an approach where he created our environment and the physical world, that he created time also. But for God, time is just one of the many dimensions that he can be free from. He is able to step back. And someone compared it to having a film strip of time that where you can see both the first and the last still, at the beginning and the end. And perhaps that is really the wonderful ability that God has, that he then is able to share and give to his prophets on the stream of time and tell them this is what's going to happen. And the validation of that, that this actually will happen, is really what confirms that God is the true God. It doesn't necessarily have to say, oh, Isaiah was the prophet of God, I believe in Isaiah. No, but that God has the ability to give his prophets the exact information of what's going to happen in the future so that God's credibility can be established. And it's important to have the credibility of the prophet as well. So this predictive prophecy, again, is to demonstrate that the true God is the originator of the message when the prophecy comes true. And therefore, those very exact prophecies about Babylon and Cyrus, who is even mentioned by name 150 years before his birth, are completely fine, but completely difficult to accept for someone who does not have faith. Another scripture that was fulfilled is the one that Jesus himself mentions in Luke 4:17. And in Luke 4:17 we read, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unscrolled the scroll. We kind of can have the same experience as we look at the Dead Sea Scrolls, and likely that was the script that he saw there. He unscrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written. And he quoted Isaiah 61. So take a look at this. At that time, in that synagogue, everyone knows that this is the book of Isaiah. Jesus himself goes all the way possibly to the end of that scroll, close to the end, to chapter 61, and opens it up and reads from the book of Isaiah. And he rolled up the scroll, and we know the words, the Spirit of the Lord is upon me, he anointed me to proclaim good news, and so on. And then Luke 4:20 says, and he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down, and the eyes of all the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing. A And now chapter 53. This is where we kind of take this this license to name the title going back to the looking back at the future. Because what is so interesting about chapter 53? Unlike prophecies that usually tell you this is what shall happen, this is what will take place, the tense of the prophecy is past. Who has believed our report? In fact, some translations say, who would have believed our report if we told you about this? We were telling you about this for years and years, and when it happened, it actually came true. He was pierced for our transgressions and crushed for our iniquities. And his punishment is what brought peace. Everything is in past tense, as though looking at a future event from the past. And that's how we look at this right now as well. Some lessons that come to us about relying on God here and having faith, perhaps in the times of our even political upheavals that are happening even right now in this country. A similar situation perhaps to what the king Ahaz was to do when he was either going to join a confederacy against Assyria with Israel, that's the northern kingdom, and Syria, or perhaps go and have a pact with Assyria themselves. That's the path that he chose, and the Lord, through Isaiah, did not commend that. The right path would have been for him to be focused and faithful to the Lord. And as we look at our events today, whether it's this candidate or that candidate, this path or that path, our focus is on the Lord. And whatever is in his design and in his plan is going to be what will happen in the different events and decisions in the world. And we really should be looking at that plan and at that focus rather than anything specific that would take place right now. Many charges against Judah and Isaiah. And Judah in Isaiah. We ask, how is it possible that a nation so close to the Lord, so enlightened by his laws and protected by his power, was able to get to this condition? And yet it was possible that the closeness seemed to desensitize them from the fear, carefulness, increase their arrogance, and reduce their faith. Would it not be a good thing for us to remember that? Are we not ourselves at that risk of being very close to something we hold true and think is very, very valid? May we not be desensitized? May we be as proper and upright and just and right so that these words of Isaiah and charges against them would not apply to us? We find the poetry part that hopefully we'll be able to enjoy for a minute. Poetry is typically to us something that we will recognize right away. It will either be a rhyme or a rhythm. And, of course, in the English language, it may work slightly differently. So back in the days of, I think, either 1700s or so, there was a writer who did his own translation of the book of Isaiah, but he was trying to say what actually can be found about poetry in this book. And this is what he concludes. Thus much then I think we may be allowed to infer from the alphabetical poems, namely that Hebrew poems are written in verse, properly so called, that the harmony of the verse does not arise from rhyme, that is from similar corresponding sounds terminating the verses, but some sort of rhythm, probably some sort of a meter, the laws of which are now altogether unknown and wholly undiscoverable. Well, I don't know exactly if he was right, but we know that the Jewish nation cherished the Hebrew language. Even though perhaps the pronunciation is slightly different, yet maybe there are some ways to discover that rhythm and rhyme and poetry, and maybe even to our ears. So to prove that, I have a little clip from chapter 5, verse 7, about the vineyard of the Lord. And I'm going to play that to see if we would find there some rhythm. These words are not read by Isaiah, I wanted to say, of course not. They are read by the by a Jewish monk, actually, who became a monk in the Greek Orthodox Church. But his name is Abraham Shmuelov, and to him we owe the whole Old Testament being read in Hebrew. But let's listen to this. I'm going to play the clip of that twice, just so that we hear that rhythm and possibly a rhyme. So here it goes.
כי חרם אדוני צבאות בית ישראל, ואיש יהודה נטע שעשועיו, ויקב למשפט, והנה מספח, לצדקה, והנה צעקה.
And once again.
ויקב למשפט, והנה מספח, לצדקה, והנה צעקה.
And I think we do feel a little bit of a rhythm and a little bit of poetry there. And now, a final scene from for our slides, although not really a final scene in Isaiah. This is chapter 6, where Isaiah is called to his mission. And when he sees the wonderful six-winged angel who also puts coal on his lips and purifies them, because Isaiah feels so unworthy of what he is about to do and unworthy of seeing, God's glory, appreciates it so much. But the scene here is encapsulated in the hymn Holy, 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 because these are the words that are being used here. Also, they are used then in Revelation. And let's listen to just a short clip of how these words may have been written in Hebrew and said in Hebrew then. And in fact, interestingly enough, they will not be just said but also sung. So let's hear this.
Vekara ze el ze veamar kadosh 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 Adonai tsevaot melo.
And how interesting is it that in the appreciation for this verse, holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts, the whole earth is full of his glory, that this reader felt that he could no longer read it in prose, but that he had to chant it, just perhaps as it is very normal to chant, a lot of verses. And this is a very elated text. It talks about the time when the whole earth will be full of his glory. Those times are, we believe, very soon. Maybe they were not yet at the time when Isaiah was seeing this vision, and maybe not yet right now when the earth is still filled with violence and vice. But we look forward to the times when we can be part of this vision fulfilled. Holy, holy, holy is the Lord. And I hope these findings were a blessing, and may the Lord bless us as we continue to study the words of this book and the words of the whole Bible.